welcome to Truth Jihad Radio, the radio show that goes all out for truth. Four times a week, five plus guests telling you hard truths, all sorts of suppressed information. Usually it's all the most important issues covered honestly, which is something the mainstream can't do these days. Well, we're going to bring on one of our favorite all-time regular guests, a guy who just passed through Madison, Wisconsin, and wowed them with his truth speaking and his jazz saxophone. And of course, that would be Gilad Atzmon. Gilad is a first-class jazz player and a first-class thinker who specializes in systematically violating taboos, particularly the whole taboo against speaking out of turn about all things Jewish, Jewish culture, the relationship between Jewish identity, politics, and Zionism, all those things that you're really not supposed to talk about, even if you're in the Palestine Solidarity Movement. Gilad speaks about them brilliantly, honestly, provocatively, and of course, he gets all kinds of guff from the usual suspects for doing so, and even some of the unusual suspects as well. So it's always fun to talk with Gilad. Welcome, Gilad Atzmon. How are you?
I'm so delighted to be with you once again. It is always an enlightening adventure to talk to you. I learn more than you think, more than I'm supposed to, because I'm supposed to be the knowledgeable guy, but you happen to deliver a lot of good thought-provoking ideas.
Well,
By the way, I really enjoyed, I started to read your book. I'm kind of launching my book now, but I really love your book, man. The Charlie Hebdo.
Well, thank you.
Book. It's a level of discussion that we don't see anymore anywhere. Except within the truth movement, and I really miss it. This was kind of academic exchange that I remember when in the 80s, you know, late 80s, when I went to university, it was still like that. I now visit universities, and it's, you know, the identity politics and all this nonsense and the Chomsky crap, you know, didn't leave much of our Western intellectual life.
I think they've really dumbed down the universities. I don't think it's just me. I mean, yeah, I was young and naive when I first went to the university. And, you know, I got my undergraduate degree in journalism at the University of Wisconsin in, like, up through 1981 was when I graduated. And I spent a few years messing around, having fun, and then got into the intellectual world in San Francisco of cafes and so on, and found my way back to San Francisco State University because it seemed that in the American Academy in general and San Francisco State in particular, which is a haven for unusually interesting or talented people who just want to be in San Francisco, so they'll teach at a state university, this seemed like a place where there was a lot of really open and honest discussion where people could do the research, take the approaches that they wanted to. I didn't see any real censorship while I was there. There was interesting conflict on Israel-Palestine, of course. The Palestinian students and the Zionist students were always fighting each other. But but it was a very open environment. It was like, you know, it's sort of almost like the Wild West. You know, the 60s had ebbed. It wasn't quite as politically radical as it had been. But I didn't feel like there were red lines and third rails things you just couldn't talk about. You know, I could bring up the JFK assassination being an obvious CIA conspiracy and nobody blinked and almost everybody already knew that. And all these things, people talked about them. And today, it seems like, I don't know if they're putting fluoride in the university water supplies or what, but like you said, there's this suffocating sort of political correctness that seems to be tied in with identity politics. And you've done a whole lot to expose that.
What is amazing for me is who are the people who actually carry this censorship. It is quite amazing to see that it is the followers of Chomsky who are there to restrict the boundaries of freedom. Because Chomsky, I regard Chomsky as a really miniature intellectual. It's slightly pathetic, uniquely boring, which is certainly the ultimate crime as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I would
But
agree he's
Chomsky,
overrated.
but definitely, but Chomsky had one good thing about him. Some people actually find now evidence that this is not entirely the case, but at large, he was an advocate of freedom of speech.
Even for
Now,
Holocaust deniers.
exactly, the one good thing that I think that I would credit him for is was his take on Faurisson, although he kind of zigzagged his way out of it. However, it is very clear to me that it is actually the left, or within the Palestinian Solidarity so-called movement, it is the JVP, the Jewish Voice for Peace, who are desperate to restrict the discussion, and their agenda is very clear. By the way, nobody knows about it out of JVP leaders, but JVP in the last 3 weeks, I think around the 5th of May or the 10th of May, I don't know exactly when. I have the letter with me. I'm happy to share it with you. I don't share it with the public yet because I'm waiting for Alice and Weir to react to it first.
Hey, great. So you're breaking this on my show. Thank you.
JVP sent letter. JVP leader, apparently it was written by the JVP secretary, Rebecca Wilkomerson, basically perpetrated the Talmudic cherem, excommunication on Alison Weir. They wrote to her that they want to disassociate with her. She is not welcome anymore to the Jewish shtetl, to the Jewish territory. It's a very devastating letter. I will
Jeez, do
definitely.
they have to put her foreskin back on? Wait a minute, that wouldn't work for anyway, go ahead.
No, it's unbelievable. This is kind of measures. This is like a Middle Ages measures, and these are the people who are calling themselves our best allies. It is hilarious. It is hilarious. But I now, after being with you and giving this talk all over America, and actually I was very pleased with the reaction to the talk. I saw more people in most places. Most places doubled the audience doubled. The questions were fascinating and actually led me to develop my ideas. And I think that now I've, again, I'm breaking it out in your show. I think that I've managed now to come with almost the formula of Jewish survival within the West. And it's quite simple. It's quite simple. And I think that you will have to agree with it. It's as follows. Once the Jews recognize that an appearance or their conduct or their politics, something about them is becoming a Jewish problem. For instance, Palestine at a certain stage became a Jewish problem. The 2008 with Lehman Brothers and Goldman Sachs, at the center of it, became a Jewish problem. Banking in general is a Jewish problem. Hollywood is on the verge of becoming a Jewish problem. Once the Jews realize that something about them
Even
doesn't,
9/11 Truth, Gilad, has
even
become more of a
9/11,
Jewish problem.
exactly,
Yeah,
exactly.
Charlie
Well,
Hebdo, et cetera.
a lot of things can become a Jewish problem. Once they recognize that this is the situation, even Pamela Geller is now a Jewish problem, and I'll this was
She's a
actually fun.
major Jewish problem.
Exactly. No, she's and exactly, it was actually Pamela Geller that I think invoked this insight in me.
She's definitely not a credit to her race, as they used to say.
Okay, so check it out. Once a thing, whatever it is, an idea, a person, an institution, a state, is becoming a Jewish problem. And we see immediately the appearance, we witness apparently, immediately the appearance of a satellite miniature imaginary dissent. Because what does it mean that something is becoming a Jewish problem? A lot of goyim, the Gentiles, as the, you know, the Jews call them goyim, they start to, they are kind of becoming very angry and happy to throw the Jews as a collective under the wheels of the bus. When this happens, we always see an imaginary satellite. So in the case of Pamela Geller, for instance, it's the ADL. It's the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's very Jewish organization, Zionist affiliated, are attacking. When this happened, rather than the American public media society rounding the Jews for the crimes committed by Pamela Geller, the Gentiles, the host nation, is moving aside and forming an arena around the Jewish debate. It becomes a Jewish internal debate. When it came to Palestine, Palestine became a Jewish problem. A lot of people are angry with the Jews because of the crimes that are committed by the Jewish state. We see the rise of JVP and all these Jewish organizations say, oh, we don't agree with Israel. You see, not all the Jews are that bad. Once this happened, the goyim moves aside. It becomes a Jewish internal issue. 2008, you know, the banking, so on, you know, the credit crunch. You know, it took 2 years for Saban to produce the best film about the collapse of the banking system. And the heroes in this film were Soros and Strauss, who later became the French. He was the French financial minister, and then he was the IMF chief of the IMF or whatever, you know. And they are basically two Jewish Zionists who were the first to be vocal against, you know, the measures that were taken by the Jewish bankers and the Federal Reserve.
Strauss get set up with he got set up with some kind of scandal to perhaps disable his light critique of the bankers.
By the way, I'm not sure. It's not clear whether it was set up because, as you probably know, he had now another case in France. Mm-hmm. So he's libidinally.
Libidinally challenged,
which is something that is apparently slightly common amongst this Jewish elite, and
probably most of the elite period, I would think.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. You know, I'm waiting to see how the Dershowitz thing develops.
No, I mean, but, you know, anyway, at least these guys are not like the Bush family, you know, going after kids.
Anyway. So what I'm saying, whenever anything is becoming a Jewish issue, you know, we see the rise of imaginary Jewish dissent. Once this happens, it is very convenient to the so-called goyim, to the Gentiles, to move out and to let the Jews fight between themselves. Why it is very convenient for the goyim? Because it is, generally speaking, a tolerant discourse, the Christian Athenian discourse, you know. So they are very happy not to round the Jews and to kick him out of the country as they did for many years. They let the Jews deal with the issue with themselves. It is obviously extremely convenient for the Jews. It is a form of a symbolic relationship. Now, what we see when we look at it historically, we see that we have a chain of Jewish misleading debates, you know, because that stops us from actually seeing the history for what it is. Because when you look at the Cold War at a certain stage, we do realize that it's actually a war between Bolsheviks and a few capitalist bankers. It's an internal Jewish debate. We look at Palestine, and then we see, oh my God, by the time we realize that it's actually a debate between few Jews, between the Zionist and the so-called Jewish anti-Zionist, completely dismissing the Palestinians and their needs or their cause. Every time we are ready to acknowledge that this is the case, it is only because the Jews are already concentrating on another struggle. They left this one behind. They are not interested. There is no much interest in Palestine anymore. And there is a it's a kind of a devastating contest, and the Jews are most ahead of everyone else most of the time. The few times that their host nation is taking the lead is when we see a colossal disasters. This is where we see Holocaust, where this is where we see devastating attacks on Jews, and this happens once every 100 years or so. It's a cycle.
In
It's
a
a
certain sense, though,
devastating cycle.
Gilad, even the Nazis versus Jews thing was an internal Jewish debate in the sense that the big banksters who are disproportionately Jewish seem to have set the Nazis up for their own purposes, although that was sort of a false
Yeah,
flag. Nobody.
I'm aware of these studies. However, you know, I think that this is a very complicated chapter in history because no one is willing to talk about this part of history because we are basically not allowed. You know, for me as a European, it is very, very dangerous. But the more I look into it, the more I look into it, I think that the more I become a supporter, an avid supporter of every form of revisionist thought. I think that it will be impossible to look at the resentment towards Jews, you know, in Europe, without taking into account our understanding of Jewish identity. That is something that evolved ra rapidly since that chapter. You know, and this is the whole idea of historical research. Historical research is the ability to look at the past as we are moving along. So it means that if our understanding of a concept, for instance, our understanding of the Jew has evolved, we now go back and examining our history, our past, in the light of this more profound or less profound, whatever, understanding of a notion or a historical development. Now, this is something that we cannot really do with the Holocaust due to laws that restrict our engagement with this chapter, which is amazing.
It is, yeah. Here in the United States, there isn't that legal barrier that there is. You know, in some European countries, you go to jail if you start saying the wrong thing about this.
No, in America, definitely you don't. You definitely don't have a legal barrier, but you have a social barrier.
Right. You might lose your job and
So,
your career, which isn't that
yeah,
much fun.
exactly, which is as bad. But for me, you know, I'm not really an historian, and I cannot contribute to the study of the historicity, but as a philosopher, I do realize that if we restrict some notions within our language, crucial notions, crucial political notions within our discourse, we restrict their evolvement, their natural development, it only suggests that we have a lot to conceal.
Right.
Now, I do accept that the Holocaust is something that Jews want to conceal, because when you look at it, you understand that it is very, very embarrassing. It is very, very embarrassing that that an entire nation wants to kick you out, and then their neighbors want to kick you out, and you end up kicked out from a continent. It is shocking story. It is a shocking story, and we have to deal with this story, because if we were dealing with this story appropriately, we would probably could help the Israelis and the Jewish lobby to handle the situation in the Middle East, because as things are, the entire Middle East is going to turn against them, you know, and this is just, it's an inevitable now.
Well, you hear in a certain Jewish discourse that, you know, we're basically innocent, we just keep getting kicked out from everywhere as, you know, the world's favorite scapegoats and innocent victims.
Okay, so let's put the Jewish nation, let's take them to the shrink, let's take the Jewish nation to the shrink as a kind of an identity politics, and they sit in front of this clever shrink and they say, hey, we were there and we were kicked out because they were bad to us, and we kicked out and we kicked out and we kicked out 700 times. I don't think that the shrink, you know, it would cost a lot of money to tell him 700 tales. Actually, 700 tales is when Bernard Lazar wrote about it. After that, since then, we had another few cases. We don't have to come to wait 700. After 2, 3, 4, 5 times, the shrink will tell you, listen, you know, is it possible that there is something about you that provokes such an animosity? Let's try to look. Let's go back and look into this situation. And by the way, this is exactly what Bernard Lazar did in the late 19th century. He was a Zionist. He looked into it, and he found it took him very short time to find that there is something slightly annoying in Jewish supremacy that made the Jews unwelcome in so many places, so many different places. Now, interestingly enough, Zionism accepted this concept and voted to change the Jew. This is amazing.
Right, so Zionism is a form of anti-Jewish prejudice.
totally. Zionism, this is something that always rabbinical Jews are saying. Zionism is anti-Semitism. Zionism accepted all the anti-Semitic template. They accepted there is something uniquely wrong about a diaspora Jewish identity. And he promised to change it. They promised, A, to take the Jews from the Goyim, to give the Goyim a break, and to present the world with a beautiful new Jewish revised and civilized character. And the failure of Zionism is tragic and astonishing, because to start with, it is very clear that Zionism is the most is probably the most radical manifestation of Jewish bad behavior, but at the same time the most profound critics of Israel, they are not coming from JVP or Marxist Jews, wherever they are, what is left out of them, another pathetic Jewish invention. They're actually coming from Israel, you know, whether you agree, whether you don't agree. Uri Avneri is an amazing and voice of dissent to Israeli barbarism. Gideon Levy.
Yeah.
Is for me pretty much the same. Israel Shamir was a very interesting thinker for more than a while. He's less active now, but I'm sure that he's still very clever. Shlomo Zand.
Yeah.
We don't have anything like anything that is as critical academically and scholarly profound from diaspora Jews. The only one who is maybe close is Finkelstein, Norman Finkelstein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even he isn't quite there. That's interesting.
He's not.
In
He's
fact,
not.
Gilad Atzmon, if you had grown up in the diaspora, I don't know if you would be quite the incredible iconoclast that you are.
You're right. I definitely see my it is very interesting. I definitely see my work as in the context of my Israeli upbringing. You know, we grew up to say what we think. And it means that if this Ayelet Shaked thinks that Arab should be kicked out of the desert, she's saying it. But it applies also to Shlomo Zand, to Gilad Atzmon, or to Israel Shamir, or to, I forgot, obviously, Israel Shachak. You know, it applies to us all. As you probably know, I hardly get any problems with Israelis. The people who are my arch detractors are Jewish anti-Zionists. They don't want
strange,
me to talk.
It's
not very. It's not that strange, because they know that I expose their lie. Israel is the Jewish state, and they and its manifest its Jewish symptoms. And the role of the Jewish anti-Zionist is to conceal this shame. And I don't feel that I can allow them to do it. I see my role as an intellectual in a very simple, you know, it is just to unveil the concealed, the shame, this shame, and it is a big shame. And it is very interesting, you know, because when Norton Professor Norton Mezvinsky, who was a co-writer with Israel Shachak, you know, he's still is a very, very sharp mind, when he read my work, he was actually fascinated, and he said, "Are you crazy, Gilad Atzmon? Is the true spirit of Jewish scholarship." This was kind of quite surprising, but there were quite a few Jewish scholars who repeated this exactly same line.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a great tradition of iconoclasm in Jewish scholars. Of course, intellectual life really is largely about thinking something new, which means being iconoclastic. But I think Jewish scholarship has been, you know, has excelled in that. We had Marx revealing the unconscious of capitalism, and Freud revealing the unconscious of psychology.
Sure.
You're kind of revealing the unconscious of Zionism and Jewish identity politics.
For sure, this is exactly the story. And then, it was shockingly enough, you know, I'm sure that you are familiar with the work of Mark Ellis.
Oh, yeah. He was in the book I edited, 9/11. Or actually,
yeah.
No, he wasn't. He was going to be in the book, but he gave me like a 150-page essay. And I said, well, that's, you know, our book is way too big already. I'm really sorry, because this is a great essay. But, you know, so he published that somewhere else. But I was in communication with him.
Interestingly enough, Mark Ellis, who is regarded by those Jewish crypto-Marxists as a hero, is the kind of leading theologian, Jewish theologian. As you say, theologian or theologian?
Theologian, yeah.
Theologian, yes, my God. I'll never speak English. he dedicated his the last chapter in his last book about the Jewish prophets to me, arguing that I am what I'm doing is totally consistent with the Jewish biblical prophets. Now his supporters freaked out.
Well, good for him. So he's that just shows he's for real. I mean, he's, you know, he was also willing to be in our 9/11 truth book. Yeah, but this prophetic Judaism, looking back to the history of the prophets, I think is a brilliant concept. And yeah, that would put you sort of in that line.
But I tell you what I think. I really thought about it. I really, really thought about it. To start with, I'm not a prophet. I wrote to him. You know that I'm basically a reactionary essentialist. I'm reactionary.
Yeah.
I'm reactionary because I'm the total opposite of the progressives. The progressive all the time tell us that we are moving in, and when we look how they look, it looks to me a total disaster. It looks to me something that, you know, I wouldn't even, you know, a detachment from the human condition. Mm-hmm. And I say, how is it possible that we are we claim to move in and we actually we claim to, that we are moving in and we actually in practice moving backward. And this is why I am reactionary. I think that there is something in the human condition that restricts us, you know, restrict us. And this can be a lot of fun when you celebrate it, and it can be slightly devastating when you are bounded by it. But this is why I am an essentialist. Because for me, as a philosopher, the most crucial question is, what is the meaning? What is the meaning? Is beauty is something that we deal with aesthetics? What is the meaning of being? Is why we deal with metaphysics? What is the meaning of knowing? It's a question that we ask within the domain of epistemology. And I am asking, what is the meaning of the Jew? You know, it's a very, it's kind of a minor question.
Right, but you're taking that up from a reactionary essentialist point of view is committing the ultimate heresy for a whole lot of folks.
Exactly, exactly. And they are freaking out because for them to ask essential questions, yeah, is exactly, is the ultimate heresy, is the ultimate jeopardy of that which they tried to destroy. But for me, as a person who was born in Jerusalem, yet is enlightened by the spirit of Athens, this is the only question I am interested. For me to understand humanity is to understand what humanism is all about. You know, to ask essential question about humanism, when humanism starts and when it stops to be humane. And exactly the same question could be applied to the Jew, when a thing stops being Jewish. Is it just when you start to love your neighbor? Is it when you turn your other cheek? Or is it something that we can formalize in a farther abstract way? Let's say, you know, just being among others, universal, only being adopting a notion of universalism, you know, as opposed to tribalism. I try to use a broader categories, and it is quite clear why the people who are operating with these Jewish tribal cells and pretending to be peace lovers, yet don't want the Palestinians to return to their homes, are why they see me as an enemy. And they're right. I am the enemy.
Very interesting. Well, you know, getting back to that sort of religion of progress that being a reactionary essentialist is heresy against, I think that that's actually itself sort of a Christian heresy, to a certain extent, a Judeo-Christian heresy. But as I see it, this false religion of progress that happened after the Enlightenment and gave birth to humanism as we understand it, it's a reaction against Christianity, and in particular, these limits, inherent limits on humanity posited by Christianity, particularly original sin. The original sin says that, the whole creation is fallen, human nature is fallen. Not a whole lot we can do about that. Mainly, we just have to sort of transcend it by enduring it and having this faith and going to paradise in the next world, sort of thing. So that was a Christian ideology, and then the humanistic reaction against that basically posited the perfectibility of humans and society in the world. So let's go out there and engage in material world endeavors, building things and so on, changing our social structure, which we can do ourselves, make the world better. And so they've been working very hard to make everything better, make better laws for people, better rules, better technologies, paving the earth, putting a Walmart on every block and a McDonald's on every corner, to make the world better. And that's the religion of progress. It's getting better and better and better, right? Well, no, it's not actually. As you say, in the larger picture, it's getting worse and worse and worse.
Even when we talk about it in material terms, our followers, our kids, our children are going to be less rich than us, and you are probably less rich than you're definitely less rich than your parents.
I'm significantly less rich than my parents.
Okay, now this is a general thing. People tell me, I tell people, I'm getting to the age of 50 and I'm slightly tired of touring and I think maybe to slow down. And people tell me, no, you cannot slow down. Don't you understand that your kids are not going to walk, and become something that we all accept? The fact that we are not moving forward is obvious, and we are not moving forward because the progressive ideology that divided our society into sectors. We learn to speak as a woman, as a man, as a gay, as a white, as a black, as a Jew, as a Muslim,
As a
as a
conspiracy theorist, in my
transgender,
case.
as a conspiracy theorist, and we all engaged in sectarian wars instead of looking after the most precious things in society, which are manufacturing, health, and education. Education. Look at what happened with education in America. Your kids are expected to pay $50,000 a year to eventually to end up with a paper, with a first degree, BA or graduate or whatever, that was nothing, just to maintain a fantasy that they one day be accepted to the elite. It is crazy. Now, why I go back to the Jews? Why the Jews like the notion of progressive? It's obvious. Progressive is the secular continuation of chosenness. If you are progressive, it means that you believe that some other people are reactionary. It is exactly the Jewish Talmudic divide between the chosen and the goy.
And some of my progressive friends do seem to take it kind of that way.
For sure. For sure. And this is a supremacist. They all the time talk about white supremacists and all this, white supremacists. While they are engaged in a discourse that defeat true tolerance and diversity.
That's true. On the other hand, somebody who is a white supremacist, let's say, or for that matter, a Jewish supremacist, taking Jewish as an ethnic racial category, or whatever, a Chinese supremacist, or what have you, that's a somewhat different notion because it posits that people are born as superior to other people, whereas these progressives imagine themselves as having achieved the correct viewpoint through education and knowledge, and they think that that's open to everybody, regardless of race, color, or creed.
I want to ask you something about because you know I'm a foreigner, you know, I can hardly speak English, you know, so
You do pretty well.
okay, but you know, I definitely don't understand American culture well enough. You know, I'm a jazz musician and I play with a lot of black artists, and I've never heard, it occurred to me a few days ago, I never heard a single black musician speaks about white supremacist. You know, I was quite surprised by it, because the Jews, the left Jews, the JVPs, or you know, and the leftists in general, they all the time talk about white supremacists, but my black musician friends are supposed to be the people who are kind of offended or worry or concerned with white supremacism, and they don't even use these term. They don't basically don't see the white supremacists as their immediate enemies. They usually see the policeman.
Right. Well, the policeman's the guy who's a threat to their life
And actually,
life
when
and
we think
limb.
about it, the policeman is just a person who is put in this job, you know, in order to threaten those musicians and basically a very big sector in society. But I really don't think that there is such a vivid notion or concern of white supremacy among within black communities, and if there is, it's more latent. And I think that our Jews in the movement or within the dissent or Jewish leftists use this notion all the time. All the time. I see it like every day when I'm logging and monitoring the discourse. Like you cannot find a single paper about America and American politics without labeling someone as a white
Yeah,
supremacist.
that's how they—that's how like Max Blumenthal attacked you, is by th sort of throwing you in with supposed sort of neo-Nazi skinheads, white supremacists.
Now, the reason that they do it, I think, there are two reasons. A, they are projecting their own clear racist approach or understanding of the world, because they themselves, even Max Blumenthal himself, is operating within Jews only political cells. He would say, "I signed the Jews letter, Jewish letter." What does it mean that it's a Jewish letter? It means that you, Kevin, cannot sign on this letter against me. You are not racially qualified. So he's basically a racist person who operate within racially oriented cells. This is one thing, and the other thing is that they call those people whom they don't like white supremacists because they themselves, as white people, are afraid of those people, and they try to recruit the black into this battle, which is something that they do since the civil rights movement, pretty much.
Well, maybe even since the Civil War, because in the aftermath of the American Civil War, there was, of course, the effort to enfranchise and empower the freed slaves, which I think was a good thing. And the allies of the people doing that were often, there were a lot, disproportionately Jewish Northerners. Not, of course, there were a lot of non-Jewish ones too that went south. They were called carpetbaggers, helped the black population out and against certain elements of the white population, and then that led to Ku Klux Klan hating Jews and blacks, and so there's that whole history that they're sort of continuing.
This is definitely the case, but it is at the end of the day an imaginary bond, because as I see it, by the time the civil rights movement was pretty much shattered, the black population in America didn't stayed in the pretty much the same place. while the Jews located themselves as institutionally as the dominant voice on issues to do with race and discrimination, which is amazing.
Considering... It is, isn't it? I mean, the whole civil rights movement was about empowering black people. It didn't very much. It mostly empowered Jewish people somehow. How did that work?
This is survival strategy, and we are doing now the same, exactly the same thing to the Palestinians. To the Palestinians, exactly the same thing. Now, you know, it will, you know, people don't need me to tell them that George Soros funds BDS and BDS changed its goal statement, you know, to appease the Jews. You know, they're basically a few corrupted, uniquely corrupted Palestinians, basically, were happy to go with it. But the old Palestinian, the other day when I left, a few days ago, when I left New York, I saw this amazing debate on Mondo Wise, how they take it now to court and they will fight for the right to BDS. And there is this case between BDS supporters and Zionists who are anti-BDS. And I thought to myself, my God. It's not about the right to BDS. It's about the right to return. It's about the Palestinians' right to return. It became now a huge battle about how the Jews fight between themselves rather than what we give to the Palestinians or what can we do for Palestine. This is very, very clever. They did it to the black Americans. They did it to the Spanish in the Spanish Civil War. And were defeated there, and it is a very they did it to the Russians. Look what it did. What is the Bolshevik Revolution? You know, we are talking about black Americans and Palestinians. This is small. Look what they did to the millions of people, nation, a full nation. You know, Yuri Slezkin writes about it. In you know, he said in the beginning of the 20th century. Russian Jewry or Eastern European Jewry divided into three groups. The first group was they really wanted to be Russians, but they couldn't become Russians because the Russian patriot, the Slavophilic, were very racist. So a third of them went to Palestine and pretended to be Russians. And this is basically me. You know, I know all the Russian culture, the Russian songs. I really know it very well. But my family couldn't be Russian in Russia. They could only be Russian in Palestine on the expense of the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. The second, third, they really wanted to be Russians. They couldn't be Russians, so they made the Russians into Jews through the Bolshevik Revolution. Mm-hmm. And this is an amazing reading by Slezkin. And by the way, this book, The Jewish Century, which I highly recommend, won the Jewish Book Award. So they were not very upset with his reading. And they said the third part of Russian Jews, East European Jews, really wanted to be Russians, but the Russians didn't let them. And they wanted to be Jews. Sorry, the third part, they really want to be Jews. And they couldn't be Jews in Russia, so they came to America, which is the Jewish promised land, according to Marx, and Slezkin accepted it. He said, this is exactly the place where you can celebrate your talent and be as rich as you can on the expense of others.
Well, New York City is kind of a Jewish promised land. There are practically as many Jews in New York as there are in Israel, I understand.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's very, 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 very interesting. And I think that we must talk about these issues openly and bear the consequences because the fate of our planet, the fate of your state in particular, is in tatters, man. It's like I'm you know, I love America. A lot, you know, it's like I'm a jazz artist. You are my Mecca. Mm-hmm. And I'm not so sure that you can lift yourself out of this disastrous situation. When I visit your universities and I see the level of discussion, and I see the next generation of American academics, you have a serious problem. And it's not very surprising. Look who are the people at Harvard, you know, your the pillar of American academia. Look when you start to understand what the people who were there, you know, leading this university, a person like Dershowitz, who is a compulsive liar. And when you understand that Dershowitz, that you know Dershowitz, you know, I'm sure that all your listeners know about this Jeffrey Epstein, this
Right. Jeffrey
pimp.
Epstein was, peddling underage girls
Yeah,
to people like Bill Clinton and Alan Dershowitz
yeah.
and
And when you realize that Jeffrey Epstein donated millions to Harvard, and you start to understand how it works. So you have this pedophile pimp sending money to your most important university, and basically, probably, I cannot say I wasn't there, you know, didn't see the process, but this is how you buy this Jewish Zionist domination.
Yeah, of course that's a partial view. I mean, there's the Jewish Zionist element in American society is of course much bigger than Dershowitz and Epstein, but it's certainly a symptom
No,
of the
it's a
leading edge
symptom
of corruption.
for sure. But this is something that is uniquely concerning. This is something that's uniquely concerning for every
Right,
American.
and the media will never really go after it all out because it's too embarrassing for them, I guess.
Okay, exactly. So we are going again, we are tapping again into this issue to do with shame, you know, and the American media is trapped because it's part of this concealment. You know, I noticed something very interesting in my talks. You know, I would have in America, I would have few Palestinians, and they were nodding in approval to everything I said.
Yeah, and we saw that in Madison, or if it,
We
there.
had there were Palestinians.
Well, no, but there we
There were,
a couple of people from an Arab Muslim background were very much nodding along with you,
yeah,
and there's
I
one person, a kind of a typical sort of Jewish liberal guy who was not, who was shaking his head.
yeah, but you know, I saw these two people, and I saw that they were, I knew that they were, I thought that they were Palestinian or Arabs, but obviously I didn't know them. But I saw quite a few Palestinians, and they were nodding, you know, their approval. They knew that I'm was telling the truth, and they usually found the first opportunity at the time of the Q&A to leave the room quietly. And I thought a lot about it, and I realized that I, without you know, honestly, I wasn't willing to go there. It wasn't my plan at all. But I realized that I exposed something about them as well. You know, for those Palestinians in America who managed, who were very lucky to escape the mess in their country, it was very, very convenient that the Jews tell them, "Okay, you can move aside. We are going to take care of it. We will do a lot of noise," and they do a lot of noise, and they do make a lot of noise. You know, but the Palestinians now realized in my talk that there is nothing left out of the Palestinian cause.
Yeah,
It's
that
all
we saw that
there.
in Madison. There's actually this self-appointed commissar of the Madison left, a fellow named Alan Ruff, who's a number one enemy of 9/11 truth in general, and me in particular at the local level, got started hating on me even before 9/11. Precisely because here I was, an American Muslim who was advocating that the Palestinians should expose Zionist power in America, and basically going around the left-wing Jewish death grip on the Palestinian discourse. And I was a challenge to that monopoly, that Jewish monopoly on Palestinian discourse. And so this guy Ruff just went bananas, and he's been, hating on me ever since.
Yeah, so there you go. This is the story, and it is a very, very devastating story. It's a very devastating story, but it explains why it's very easy to explain why Palestinians are too weak, but in the West to deal with these issues. They exile, their exilic survival strategy is basically non-existence. They are in exile for 60, 70 years, a few of them, others like just 40 or 50 or from 67. When it comes to the Jews do practice survival, exilic survival strategy for 3,000 years. It's a lot.
Well, they're
It's a
practicing
lot.
and getting pretty good at it,
A
but
lot of practicing, and I know. I when I practice the saxophone before the concert, I feel it. I feel great in the gig, and I'm doing it just for 30 years. Try to think how well I could play if I played
3,000
3,000
years.
years.
Wow. Well, that's probably a good place to cut off because we're hitting the end of the hour. But give us a couple of last thoughts and where people should go to the website.
My website is gilad.co.uk, and I think that those who read The Wandering Goo may find my new book with Enzo Apicella, A to Zion. It's basically a book of short aphorism. It's basically The Wandering Goo in 15 minutes of laughter. I think that it's worth a read.
Yeah, it's pretty hilarious. We had everybody laughing. Even the people who are uncomfortable with what you were saying at the talk in Madison were laughing at some of these entries. So, if you're going to tell the truth, make it funny or they'll kill you.
Exactly. I do think so.
All right. Well, hey, keep up the great work, Gila. That's been one of the true
Thank you so
truth
much.
tellers of our time. Look forward to the next conversation. Keep it up, man.
Thank you so much.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.